Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Kyle Mabry's at the controls this morning. And we're glad to have you listening. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be opening things wide open for healthcare questions, something that we do every other month on the show. It's the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carle Clinic in Urbana. In the course of his practice, he sees all kinds of folks, people of different ages and with different kinds of health concerns. So he has to deal with a wide range of issues in his practice, and that is why we have asked him to come and be on the show on a regular basis so that you can ask questions. And it can be anything, can be something about children, can be something about grown-ups, or whatever issues, we certainly encourage you to call in, and I know he will do his best to give you an answer. The caveat I always give, I think at the beginning of the program is, you know, do remember that over the telephone, we really can't do a diagnosis. If you have a real serious concern, you should pursue that with your own doctor or someone who can see you in person. But this is the kind of place that you can start. You can ask some very basic questions. And we do these programs because we think that it adds to your general health knowledge. And it's always a good opportunity to get a little free advice. So any and all of that, whatever questions you have, they're certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
So are we near the sort of what we think of as the end of the flu season, or could we still be seeing flu for another month or something?
Well, apparently we're not through with winter quite yet.
Well, yes, there's that.
And I know what myself and a lot of people are looking forward to some warmer weather and some sunshine, but typically the flu season tends to taper off rather dramatically in March, and we don't usually see a whole lot thereafter. Mm.
Does that have something to do with the weather? Does it have something to do with the fact that now people are going out and maybe not spending so much time indoors around in enclosed spaces where it's easy to transmit stuff?
Correct. That's exactly right.
Yeah. It seems that this has not been a very bad year for flu. At least I don't recall having read many stories about it being a real big problem with lots and lots of people being sick. Did you see people, or do you know of a lot of people who have flu?
We actually, toward, I'd say, the beginning of 2008, saw a fair number of people with flu-like illnesses because the vaccine this time around, unfortunately, didn't contain all of the viruses that, in fact, ended up circulating. When the vaccine's prepared, basically authorities give their best guess as to which strains they think will be most likely present, and that's what the vaccine is prepared to deal with. And I would say, to their credit, the vast majority of times they guess pretty well, but this time there was one particular strain that just wasn't covered with the vaccination. So we did see a fair number there, probably for a good, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, but that has fortunately subsided now.
Yeah, that's, I guess people have to bear that in mind. I suppose some people might say, hey, I got my flu shot and I got the flu anyway.
And what's true for all vaccinations is that they're not 100% effective. For any illness for which there is a vaccination, you are not going to automatically be guaranteed to never come down with that. You're primarily shifting the odds in your favor. And most good vaccines are anywhere from 75 to 95% effective.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that we talk about, particularly in the fall leading up to the flu season, at the time when it's recommended people get shots. You would still say, I'm sure you and other physicians would still say, well, you know, it's a pretty good idea. For some people, you would say, we definitely think you should. Right. And for other people, would say, you know, it's a pretty good idea.
In terms of the flu, certainly anybody over the age of 65, anybody with chronic significant underlying heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, those folks are certainly at risk of developing significant complications if they come down with influenza. The general public, it's still not a bad idea. Getting the flu is not exactly a whole lot of fun. The vast majority of folks, you know, will eventually get over it. It's truly the more at-risk individuals who can develop some fairly significant medical complications. And still in the United States, in the high-risk population, there are still a number of deaths that occur every year as a result of complications of influenza.
All right. We have some callers to talk with. Let's do that. First is in Hidalgo and in Illinois, and that's our line four, toll-free line. Hello. Yes.
Oh, I've got low sodium, 100, and they say it's supposed to run 135 or so, and they put me on 38 ounces of water, and I just wondering if you mix that in with Metamucil or something, if that counts again, or is there any, if you put more salt on your food, will that help you get it up, or how can I get my sodium back up to where it ought to be?
That's an excellent question, but a lot of it depends on why your sodium level is low to begin with.
Well, I was drinking too much water.
Okay. In that particular setting, what you've ended up doing is simply diluting your sodium values in your bloodstream by adding in excess fluid. In most instances, that will respond well to simply cutting back on the amount of fluid so that the concentration of sodium then is relatively higher. But certainly a sodium value of 100 is really quite low and indeed should be addressed by getting it back up closer to the normal range. People who have sudden drops in their sodium level can experience some fairly significant symptoms. It sounds like yours probably came down fairly gradually as a result of the excess fluid.
Yeah, I think so. But I just kind of lost my balance and things like that when they finally found out what was, that I had the problem.
Right. And the key thing here is to simply make sure that your fluid intake is restricted enough to allow your sodium to come up gradually again.
Does that take very long? Like I'm on 38 ounces of water now.
It's usually recommended that your sodium level be allowed to come up slowly. There are, in fact, medical problems associated with your sodium level rising too fast. So ideally, this would be something done slowly over a number of weeks.
Oh, yeah. So that probably be on that kind of a diet for a while then.
Sometime, yes.
Well, if you mix that water in with, I have to have Metamucil.
Mm-hmm. You need to count that water in your total.
Yeah,
that's
what I've been doing.
Right.
Okay, that's what I... Now, if you put salt on your food, will that help you any?
In your particular case, not really, simply because you've diluted it so much. The key is to restrict the water.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Bye.
We'll talk next with someone in Champaign. And this is line number one. Hello.
Oh, as someone whose family went through the whole flu thing, yeah, we did have a lot of flu.
Oh, okay. Maybe I was just lucky.
You know, one of the things, a question surrounding that, my three-year-old was diagnosed with it first. They did the nasal swab and all that stuff, and they found it to be the strain that wasn't in the flu shot, even though all of us had it. And so the doctor put him on Tamiflu, and then strongly suggested the rest of us also go on it. But we had a hard time actually getting a prescription for it because the doctors were fairly adamant that it wasn't an effective way to control the flu. We eventually did get it, and we all took it, and although we felt a little sick, none of us ever really got the flu besides my son. And so I thought, well, that's a pretty good sign. And so I wondered about your own feelings on it in general and why some doctors are hesitant to do this, that is to, I forgot what they call it, a prophylactic kind of thing?
Correct.
Right. Why they're so reluctant to do it and why we have to convince them if it's going to be effective. And then the other one is regarding, I don't know if you're familiar with the discussion about, I just seen a few things about the singulair and possible effects of and a depression and other things like that, and I think they said the FDA was going to look into it, but if you could expand on that a little bit, if you have any knowledge on it, I'd appreciate it. Now hang up and listen. Thank you.
I'm afraid at the moment I'm not aware of any information regarding singulair and depression. The medication itself is referred to as a leukotriene inhibitor. It's commonly prescribed in folks who have allergies and asthma as a way of trying to minimize those types of symptoms. I'm afraid I'm just not knowledgeable about whether there's any particular link to depression. Relative to the Tamiflu and the treatment or prevention of influenza, the medication is helpful for certain types of influenza, and depending on what the caller's son had diagnosed, the physician may have felt that it wasn't going to be particularly helpful. But in general, if there are outbreaks of influenza, especially in contained populations, most commonly nursing homes, and the type of influenza identified is in fact susceptible to the use of Tamiflu, then it's very, very common for the rest of the population who has not yet been infected to be given medication as a preventive measure. The other issue relates to the fact that within a family, if everyone else is relatively young and healthy, then you have to sort of weigh the benefits of taking the medication and the potential side effects of it versus, you know, how bad is the flu going to be for that individual. So there are a couple considerations there, but in this particular case, I'm not sure I know the exact reasons why there was some hesitation.
Okay. Well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He is here every other month for the show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. And we have another caller here in Sullivan. So we'll go right there, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, I got a question. I've had about four or five strokes in the past. It started back, oh, probably 30 years ago. And I had one approximately about a month ago. But anyway, it always seems like my right side of my head just hurts like a son of a gun, you know, like 2 or 3 days prior. And it always affects my left arm and left hand. But it, you know, no permanent damage, but it's numb for about half an hour. Excuse me, comment on that. Thank you.
The question I guess I would have for you is whether those changes in the arm and the hand are just temporary, or whether they persist for more than a day.
No, they, you know, they last maybe 4 hours.
Okay. What you're describing is like what is commonly referred to as a TIA, which stands for transient ischemic attack, and it is much like a stroke, only that it's temporary. It is thought that these may result from transient blockages in small blood vessels in the brain. This can be the result of clot from the heart traveling up in the circulation to the brain. It can be the result of plaque or sort of cholesterol debris in the carotid arteries in the neck, again, getting into the bloodstream and traveling to the small blood vessels in the brain. Have you had any specific evaluation for either of those conditions, either clot in the heart or a plaque in the carotid vessel?
Shall we say I went to a doctor years ago before he retired or just quit because of the malpractice insurance. And they done a CAT scan or something like that. And that's when I found out I had 1 year ago. But my blood, I know my cholesterol is a little high, so I try to get it down. And the blood pressure, you know, very low. It's not low, low, but low.
Well, if this has not been evaluated recently, I would strongly encourage you to see your physician to talk about potential tests involving a sonogram of the heart and the blood vessels of the neck, because in many instances, a TIA is in fact a warning sign for potentially a major permanent stroke, and there are some things that can be done to help prevent that if the cause for these can be found and then treated.
Yeah. Well, I took Lipitor, and then I took Zocor, and I got so nauseated with that Lipitor, I couldn't take it, and Zocor hurt, you know, vessel, arms, whatever, so I just kind of gave up on that stuff.
Well, that's for your cholesterol. You mentioned your blood pressure. Both of those are major risk factors for developing stroke, along with potential issues like diabetes and smoking.
No smoking.
That's good. And as I said, though, this is a potentially significant finding for developing a permanent stroke. So if you really haven't had those studies that we mentioned in terms of the sonogram of the heart and the blood vessels in the neck, I would really encourage you to do that.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right. And other questions again are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back to the first caller, and it made me think about what we have been told about fluid intake, about the importance of drinking enough water, mm-hmm. and the fact that it seems like it was not all that many years ago when what we were hearing in a lot of popular media was that people aren't drinking enough water, that we all were going around kind of borderline dehydrated. So the recommendation was that we should all be drinking more water. And so you see a lot of people who have bottles of water and as they're going around and doing their thing. And then it seems just recently there now have been some stories that said, well, maybe we underestimated the amount of water people get through the food that they eat and through other parts of their diet, so that maybe what we told people about you should be drinking X amount of water is too much. Now, I don't know that necessarily people can drink so much water that it gets to be a problem. I guess in
And the answer
it
is yes,
is, yeah, you can.
Especially if you consume it too fast.
Okay.
You may be aware there was a recent promotion where some, I think it was TV or radio station, had a contest where they had people drink as much water as they could, and it was going to be a contest to see who could drink the most in the shortest period of time. And in fact, the lady died as a result of that, and the primary cause is exactly what this gentleman had, which is a low sodium level.
Uh-huh.
But hers occurred rapidly over a matter of a few hours. Obviously, his occurred very slowly over a long period of time. And much like other characteristics in the body, if something happens slowly, you can usually accommodate to it. A good example being somebody whose blood count becomes anemic. If you do that very, very slowly, many people are walking around with blood counts that are half of normal and not feeling all that bad. But if you suddenly took out half of your blood volume, you would be in deep trouble, mm-hmm. because you don't have enough time to accommodate to that. So in this particular case, with too much water too fast, yes, that can actually be quite dangerous. In terms of the amount of fluid one needs over the course of a day, I think thirst is probably a good indicator of whether you're dry or not. In terms of the primarily the color of the urine specimen, if it is really, really dark, you probably are a little on the dry side.
Mm-hmm.
If it's fairly clear, then you're probably adequately hydrated. And as you mentioned, food contains fluid. Obviously, the other drinks that we take in contain a fair amount of water. Would I generally recommend water over beer? Probably, if you're going to get an adequate amount of fluid intake. And certainly a lot of the other beverages, you know, the soda pops and, you know, kind of flavored drinks that basically contain a lot of sugar don't add any real nutritional value. So you can probably do just as well with water, but there obviously is a fair amount of water in those substances anyway.
Right. So what do you have a ballpark kind of recommendation about how much water a person should try to drink over the course of a day?
Over the course of a day, probably close to a liter.
A liter? That's seems like an awful lot. Although, again, I suppose you do get water in other ways, but I don't know if I, you know, I'm trying to think, well, how much water do I drink over the course of the day? It would surprise me if it was anywhere near that much, a liter. I don't know.
Again, most people are getting their fluids from other sources, mm-hmm. and if you are picking fluids that don't otherwise compromise your health, as in too much sugar, too much alcohol, you're probably going to do just fine.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk with somebody else here in Philo, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I had a question concerning the caller who had some strokes and some TIAs.
Yes?
Yes, and my mother has had those. she's always been thin and in pretty good health, but she had high blood pressure. She's 83 now, but she's had, I say, been debilitated somewhat by that. I have the same body type, but I have low blood pressure, and my cholesterol is pretty good. I have higher the bad cholesterol, but enough of the good cholesterol that my doctor said that's kind of a trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, I always assumed because she had a lot of kids that that's why she had high blood pressure.
No.
I'm in my 50s now. What sorts of things? I'm a little concerned only because I'm thinking we're similar in body type, and what do I do to make sure I don't get that? I figured, well, because I have low blood pressure, I'll be fine.
And your blood pressure is, in fact, a major protective characteristic for you. Keeping your cholesterol down, making sure you don't have diabetes, not smoking, keeping your weight down, exercising regularly, all
right.
of the things that are normally recommended for the prevention of heart disease are applicable to the prevention of cardiovascular disease.
Okay. Just sort of general, just stay generally healthy and don't get overweight and don't exercise and that kind of thing.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, then I'll try to do that. Okay, thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you again. Other questions are certainly welcome. We're about midway through here with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. We do the program with him every other month. On a Monday, we call to talk to the family doctor, and that's the idea. Whatever kinds of health care questions you might have, could be for yourself, could be for your children, because he sees people of all ages in his practice. All you have to do is call us. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Something I thought I would ask you to talk a little bit about. There apparently now have been new guidelines issued for CPR. And there may be some people who have actually taken the instructional course in this and know how to do it. Or people have seen it done, whether in real life or on television, something like that. And it before, it involved this combination of putting pressure on the person's chest, and then also doing mouth-to-mouth breathing. Mm-hmm. And apparently now they have said, you don't need to do the mouth-to-mouth part. That's really not going to do anything. Now the emphasis is on the chest compression thing.
It's not that it's not going to do anything. It probably isn't as important as it once was thought. And we do need to sort of differentiate between different events as to whether it is or isn't appropriate to do the respirations in addition to the compressions.
Mm-hmm.
If, you're walking out at the mall and you see an adult suddenly collapse to the ground, there's a high likelihood that this is a cardiac problem. And the most important thing there is to simply keep blood circulating. In general, your oxygen level will gradually go down if you're not breathing, but it doesn't suddenly go down. And so the important part is to just keep blood circulating to the heart and the brain, obviously. So the recommendations here are to simply do the compressions to keep that blood circulating with the hope that very quickly, either somebody with a defibrillator or a paramedic or, somebody who can come and ideally evaluate the heart more thoroughly and then decide what needs to be done. If somebody is dragged out of the swimming pool, well, they probably drowned, and they definitely have a decreased oxygen level, and they probably would benefit from both compressions and respirations. Okay, so those two would be somewhat different. The sort of third category would be children. Mm-hmm. Most children don't have cardiac problems. That's primarily an adult situation. In kids, it truly is a 9 times out of 10 a respiratory problem, and they still would benefit from respirations. But I think the change in the guidelines for the vast majority of cases, which is the adult who didn't drown, just kind of drops, I hope would make it more likely that bystanders would give some assistance. With the advent of, in particular, HIV, people were somewhat squeamish about giving mouth-to-mouth, understandably. Hmm. So with these current guidelines, I think people will probably feel a little bit more comfortable at least providing that initial support, which is primarily compressions.
Now, if you have, if you found yourself in this kind of situation, but you had never, you hadn't taken no course in CPR, all you've ever done is see somebody do this on television, would you say to that kind of person, well, go ahead and do your best,
Or otherwise, would you say, they're just going to die.
Just leave them.
So,
okay.
No,
so
go ahead.
You go ahead and that you can't really, as long as you're not too.
Well, if they're going to be dead if you don't do anything.
Then go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay.
And in terms of chest compressions, it's really not that difficult. I would still recommend that people contact, say, their Red Cross or their American Heart Association and just take a basic CPR class, because I think people would then, in fact, feel more comfortable about knowing what to do. But it's really technically not all that difficult. Most folks are simply taught to put the heel of their hand and the other hand on top of it and simply push down on the lower part of the breastbone. The sternum, the breastbone itself, will in fact depress, and you can basically push down about an inch and a half or so and then let up, and then just push down and let up. And you'd like to do this probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 100 times a minute. So it's up and down, up and down, up and down.
So it's pretty quick.
It's actually fairly quick. And you're trying to make sure that blood continues to flow.
All right. Let's talk again with another caller. Champagne next, line one. Hello.
Hey, how you doing? Good. I got a question. Something I saw on the internet is about something called angioprem. It's something that reduces plaque and cleans up the arteries, supposedly pretty good. And also, I wanted to ask the doctor what he thought about that Bayer's over-the-counter medicines that supposed to be good for the heart. And I'll just sit back and listen to what he says about that.
Regarding the first one, angioprem, I'm not at all familiar with that. If it's a prescription medication, I'm sorry, I just don't know. If it's an over-the-counter medication, unfortunately, like a lot of things sold over-the-counter, they can almost claim anything they want and sort of get away with it, but it's usually more advertising than it is true efficacy. So I'm sorry, I'm just not familiar with that particular product. The only other cardiovascular product that I'm aware Bayer makes over the counter is aspirin.
Well, I wonder if that's what the caller was asking about, because they're certainly in their advertising have suggested that for some people, taking a very small dose of aspirin, just regular aspirin, taking it daily can have a beneficial effect. And I guess I don't recall if this is for people who have had a heart attack
There's good data that suggests that anybody who's had any type of cardiovascular disease will, in fact, benefit from the regular taking of an aspirin a day. What's currently being advised is that folks who perhaps have cardiovascular risks but no known disease yet might benefit from low-dose aspirin. What's commonly referred to as the children's aspirin dose, which is only 81 milligrams. This is a quarter of an adult aspirin. The typical adult aspirin is 325 milligrams. So in situations where somebody, say, has high blood pressure or cholesterol or diabetes or a strong family history of heart disease, then the 81 milligram aspirin on a daily basis, as long as they don't have any other contraindication to taking aspirin, would be fine.
Mm. And am I right in thinking that this is aspirin is a blood thinner?
Not technically. Okay. It is what would be more appropriately referred to as an antiplatelet agent. Platelets are the little sticky substances in our blood vessels that prevent us from hemorrhaging if we get a paper cut. Platelets basically plug up that little tiny cut and allow then it to stop bleeding. But if you have a major source of bleeding, you activate your entire clotting system. And platelets really don't affect the major aspects of your clotting system. But that small injury, it is valuable there. It's thought that platelets, in combination with cholesterol, tend to stick to the inside of blood vessels. Mm. And making those platelets just a tiny bit less sticky is thought to help minimize the attachment then of cholesterol as well to the blood vessel wall.
Yeah. I do know that there is one of the manufacturers of multivitamin supplements has now added, and I think that it's Centrum, has added something, and I'm afraid I can't tell you what it is, but has added something that they are claiming may be helpful in reducing cholesterol. And I'm not sure what. I guess in what I'm asking here, and maybe it also touches on what the caller was asking about, is as far as you know, is there anything in the way of some kind of a supplement that you could do over the counter, vitamin, mineral, something that has been, you know, demonstrated to your satisfaction can actually have some benefit in lowering cholesterol?
The answer would be niacin, which is one of the B vitamins, has been found in pharmacologic doses to be helpful in lowering cholesterol. The problem is that your average vitamin supplement has a sort of a vitamin supplement kind of dose, mm-hmm. Which is nowhere near the amount of niacin usually used to lower cholesterol. So you may have 50 milligrams of niacin in your vitamin. You need somewhere between probably 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams of niacin if you want to use it by itself to lower cholesterol. The problem is the vast majority of people can't tolerate that. Niacin in large doses causes intense flushing. And most people don't want to put up with what seems to be like a really bad hot flash. So for people who want to use niacin, they have to start out very, very slow and very, very gradually increase the dose of their niacin over a long period of time, if they can even get up to the area where it's tolerated. Now, the other over-the-counter one that is also useful is the omega-3 fish oil supplements. Taking the fish oil supplement is equivalent to eating that salmon every day that somebody says you're supposed to eat to, you know, help your cholesterol. And it's a fairly well-tolerated supplement. No real particular downside to using it in the vast majority of folks, and can be helpful in terms of lowering cholesterol. The other issues that relate to, say, diet and cholesterol would be any additional fiber can be useful for lowering cholesterol. And obviously then the actual dietary choices themselves as to what people eat and how their food is prepared make a big difference in cholesterol. We have situations relative to elevated cholesterol of two general varieties. People who have lifestyle issues, their diet, their exercise habits aren't as good as they could be to keep their cholesterol out of the cardiovascular risk range. And then we have folks who have inherited, unfortunately, a problem with their cholesterol metabolism. And despite doing all the right things, their cholesterol remains elevated. If those folks have significant cardiovascular risk associated with that, then medication to lower it becomes a reasonable thing to do.
Okay. Back to the phones, and we have somebody here on in Chicago on line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I was going to ask a question on the cholesterol-lowering drugs, the statins. And I know somebody who has a cholesterol problem has been taking Lipitor and has had, you know, not had it low enough to lower the cholesterol enough. And the doctor was recommending Crestor as a substitute, but we've heard that this Crestor has had many problems as far as side effects. And do you know the latest on that as far as what the dangers of Crestor are?
The statin class of medications include perhaps a half a dozen different brand names. And like many other medication classes where there are several different drugs to choose from, certain people respond better to one than the other. It doesn't necessarily mean that one medication is better than the other. It simply means that particular individual responds better to it. And the same is probably true here. The Lipitor, Zocor, Crestor, and several others are available in the statin class of medications. Adjusting for dose, they can all be quite comparable in terms of efficacy. There are generally the same potential types of side effects or problems with all of them. And in most instances, a lot of times the choice of the medication is primarily driven by the patient's insurance company and which one is paid for at a better level than the next. And as such, I don't think there's any problem suggesting Crestor as an alternative to Lipitor if it hasn't been useful. But in terms of predicting side effects, you'd simply have to wait and see how that particular individual does with the medication.
Wasn't there some type of a government warning about a year or two ago on Crestor?
I'm trying to remember back. Something about what you're saying does kind of ring a bell, but I do not remember the specifics of that. And there has subsequently been no specific, recall or removal of the medication from the market. And it is still quite commonly prescribed.
Okay, well, thanks for your help.
Thank you. This is something that I wanted to touch on a little bit, particularly because I think that, as the caller suggests, maybe there are some people who have questions about these medications and their potential benefit and side effect. And I think also because recently there have been some questions about a different kind of medication that, as I remember it, combines two drugs. And that the companies were suggesting that is more effective than the drugs
statins
all by themselves. And then I think then somebody came along and looked at it and said, well, you know, we're not actually really sure that that's any better than the statins all by themselves.
What the medication you're referring to is called Vytorin, and it's a combination of a statin and another medication marketed individually called Zetia. And it's another type of cholesterol medication that works differently than the statins do. And so the thought was if you didn't get enough benefit on your cholesterol from the statin alone, you could add this other medication that would be complementary to it. And they simply stuck it together in one pill so that they could market it easily. The sort of controversy that has come up is around the fact that the statins have, in fact, been shown to reduce cardiovascular disease. The Zetia portion of Vytorin has not yet had any indications from studies that it lowers cardiovascular risk beyond what the statin already does. There's good laboratory evidence that it does, in fact, bring down cholesterol even farther than the statin did by itself, but the long-term question that needs to be answered is, does that then translate into a lower cardiovascular risk than what the statin alone provides? Yeah. And the medication itself, the Zetia, hasn't really been out sort of long enough to really answer that question. It's still thought, generally speaking, by most of the cardiovascular agencies that it's better to lower your cholesterol than to leave it up. You point out that there are always going to be some questions, as there should be, about the efficacy of medications and what the long-term effects are. In many instances with relatively newer medications, you have a situation where we're essentially doing large-scale population studies to figure out what, in fact, will work. Mm-hmm. And so in some instances, we're simply up against the limit of what our medical knowledge is. To oversimplify things, we know that high cholesterols are generally associated with higher risks of cardiovascular disease, and we know that lower cholesterols are associated with lower risks of cardiovascular disease. So the general thought is, get your cholesterol down. Now, within that, there are all sorts of controversies. You know, what's my HDL, my good cholesterol, versus my LDL, my bad cholesterol? There are folks who have high cholesterol totals, but it's all because they have lots of good cholesterol. Well, those people don't die of heart disease. Okay, so that's a slightly different story. And then we have the folks who have, you know, combinations of up or down HDLs or LDLs, and you start to have to pick and choose as to who would benefit from medication. And I think it's a very reasonable thing to have patients discuss with their physician, what is my individual cardiovascular risk and what are the potential pluses and minuses of medication above and beyond the lifestyle changes that the individual patient can make.
Yeah. Well, when you point out the fact that when you talk to people with about their cholesterol, when you do that, you go in, they have their blood drawn, and they take a look at this, that there is one number that you're looking at, and that is the overall number. But then what you also want to look at is the various components. You want to look at the HDL, the LDL, I guess you look at what's called triglycerides.
Which is simply another type of fatty substance like cholesterol that can potentially be associated with heart disease as well, though cholesterol is a stronger predictor for heart disease than triglyceride problems.
Mm-hmm. And that you want to try to get the LDLs, you want them to be down, but HDLs, those are the good ones. You'd like that to be up. And it seems to me like for a long time, when people said, well, oh, okay, doctor, so what can I do to raise my HDLs? I think that for a long time, the only answer was regular physical exercise. That would do it. I cannot give you a pill to raise your HDLs. Is that still pretty
interesting? Pretty close. The drug companies obviously would like to find the perfect medication that lowered your LDL, raised your HDL. There was something in trials. It didn't work out. So we're sort of back to the drawing board on that. And people also have to realize that the benefits of appropriate diet and exercise in particular, in my opinion, go way beyond what your numbers on a blood test show. There are tremendous other attributes to appropriate diet and exercise that provide overall general health benefits long past, way past, you know, what it does for your cholesterol. Yeah. So, you know, the thought that, well, I'll just take this pill and I'll be fine really doesn't pan out. People still need to pay attention to their diet. Vigorous physical activity on a regular basis is still probably one of the best things that people can do because it has added benefits in terms of keeping their weight down, reduces their risk of diabetes, keeps their blood pressure down, provides a level of cardiovascular fitness for the heart, all of which you don't get from a pill.
Yeah.
So medication is, in my opinion, always the second line of treatment after appropriate attention to diet and exercise.
So, I'm sure that when you talk with your patients, that's the message. You know, you do these basic things. You look at their weight. You ask them about their physical activity. You ask them about their family history. You check their blood pressure. You check their cholesterol. You're probably going to check their blood sugar. You know, you're going to get all those basic baseline things. And you're going to talk with them about what constitutes healthy lifestyle, something they probably already know. So when then, at what point then do you, with a particular patient, start thinking that in addition to trying to get them to do all that lifestyle stuff that you would like them to do, that you would think about maybe also this person would benefit from having some medication, for example, putting them on a statin drug?
Right. In most instances, if somebody is genuinely making a sincere effort to alter their diet and increase their exercise, we can fairly easily monitor those results, if they're going to change in terms of the laboratory studies, within 3 to 6 months. So if at the end of 6 months somebody says, I've been watching my diet, I've been getting good exercise, and we have some documentation that, in fact, their weight is down, because that should be a natural consequence of doing that, and their cholesterol really hasn't changed at all much, they may, in fact, be one of those folks who inherited sort of a bad metabolism. if that's associated with a strong family history of premature or early heart disease, then it may indeed be quite reasonable to look at medication to further lower their cholesterol. On the other hand, if they have a modestly elevated cholesterol and they say, everybody in my family lives to be, you know, 95 and gets run over by a train, you know, then maybe the cholesterol isn't a major issue, and especially if they don't have the other risk factors. They're not overweight. They don't have high blood pressure. They don't smoke. They're not diabetic. They do exercise regularly. Then there may not be a whole lot of added benefit from adding medication in that particular setting. And obviously there are sort of mixed pictures in between those two. And you simply have to sort of decide for yourself with the amount of information that we have at the moment and decide, is it in my best interest to take medication? Because this is a long-term proposition. You don't take your cholesterol medication for 6 months and then say, well, it's better, now I get to stop. As a general rule, if you're on medication, it's because it didn't come down with all the other efforts. And so you're looking at taking it long term.
Are there particular side effects? Is there any on the average? Because obviously in some people you'd say the answer is, well, yeah, because as you've always said, some people will tolerate some medications and some people won't.
Yeah.
But overall, is there any consistent kind of a downside to, say, taking a statin? And as you say, if you're going to start, you're probably going to continue.
The majority of individuals who take the statins do well. The most common thing I get is, I take a pill every day and otherwise I don't notice anything different. But when they come and get their laboratory work checked, there's often a dramatic improvement in their cholesterol. Mm-hmm. And for individuals who do have side effects and sort of an achy, sore muscle kind of sensation is not unheard of, changing the type of medication that you're taking to one of the other brands within the statin class may alleviate that. A rare complication, but potentially serious, is an alteration in liver function, but we routinely check for liver function when the cholesterol test is done as well. So in most instances there, if somebody does have a problem with their liver, simply stopping the medication will again alleviate that. But that's actually quite rare.
Hmm. We're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. It's something maybe you can just talk about for a minute or two that continues, I think, to be a concern on a lot of people. It has to do with the routine vaccinations that are recommended for kids for childhood disease. And the concern here is that there are some parents who are not having their children immunized, either because they just don't think it's important for some reason, or maybe more likely there is concern on some people's part that there is some potential serious risk associated with those vaccines. I'd be sure that you would say, look, I think that this is important. My recommendation is to you that you have your children get the vaccine. And so but then if I push you a little further and say, well, doc, you know, I'm worried about this. I read articles about problems associated with vaccine and I would really hate it to have my kids get the shots and then have something really terrible happen.
If that's the mindset that a parent has, they would never put their child in a car, because the likelihood of being in a car accident far exceeds the likelihood of a problem related to a vaccination. There would be a whole host of daily activities that you would never subject your child to for fear that they would have a problem. And again, those risks would be significantly higher than immunizing your child. I think people are in some way unaware of what the consequences of the disease processes were. The immunization of children has been so successful. Nobody's seen a case of polio. Nobody gets tetanus. No. We've seen certain types of illnesses like periorbital cellulitis and epiglottitis virtually disappear as a result of immunizations. And while no immunization is perfect, what I remind people is there's nothing in life that's perfect. But the overwhelming benefit of immunizations far outweighs their potential harm from the vaccination. Now, there are, in fact, certain individuals, and that's why it's appropriate to talk to your physician about it, who shouldn't receive certain types of vaccinations depending on their medical condition. But those are, again, kind of rare subset. The otherwise generally healthy child should not have a problem with getting the regularly recommended immunizations. One of the major controversies that has been looked at fairly recently is, was there any relationship between childhood vaccinations and subsequent development of autism? And two very large studies have been looking at that in some detail, and there really hasn't been any correlation between the vaccination itself and the subsequent development of the condition. There is perhaps some coincidental overlap in that autism is often first become aware of at a time when certain vaccinations like the MMR were also given. So, you know, it's one of those things, is it cause and effect, or is it simply something that occurs around the same time? Mm-hmm. One of the discussions I've had with patients regarding not only this but other sort of medical conditions is, you know, if the last 10 guys I saw admitted to the hospital for heart attacks all drove red pickup trucks, you know, would you say, well, gee, all I got to do to avoid heart disease is
get a black one.
Yeah, get a black one instead of a red one. Again, is it cause and effect or simply an association?
Yeah.
And those are very difficult questions sometimes to answer. But the best medical evidence that we have so far is that there is no cause and effect relationship between the vaccinations and things like autism.
All right. Our guest, Jeff Swearingen, is a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month for the show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dave.